pot. He's the prince of pot.
I've been thinking about how badly the U.S. government wants to extradite me to their gulag, and how eager the Canadian government is, both under the Paul Martin liberals and the Stephen Harper conservatives, are to export me to that gulag. You know, there's 6,000 pages of correspondence out there, emails, phone calls, bureaucratic reports between the Canadian Ministry of Justice and the B.C. Solicitor General, Richard Coleman, who was Solicitor General from 2003 to 2005, the Vancouver Police Department under Chief Constable Jamie Graham, and the RCMP, and between all those Canadians and their U.S. counterparts in the U.S. Attorney General's Office of the Justice Department, the Bush White House drug czar John Walters, DEA head Karen Tandy, and various DEA offices throughout the United States and Canada. That's 6,000 pages, all marked classified, national security only, every single word blacked out on all 6,000 pages. Now, we know this because my lawyer spent 12 months pursuing a Freedom of Information request to find out how much collaboration had gone on between top Canadian officials and top U.S. officials in my extradition case. As you know from a previous podcast of Friday, November 13th, where there is a link to a video of retired Vancouver police officer Doug Lang saying that the Vancouver police, after failing to get me charged locally in 2003, gave their file to the U.S. DEA. From that point, the Vancouver Police Department, with the active participation of Chief Constable Jamie Graham, who actually boasted about his collaboration with the U.S. to me in a 2008 meeting, did legwork for the DEA office in Vancouver. And undercover officers from DEA came to our seed desk downtown and began buying seeds over the counter from us by mail. But 6,000 pages of top secret confidential pages between top agencies of two governments is extraordinary collaboration for just one little person. That's a decade of spying, surveillance, eavesdropping, conspiring, and collusion by two governments to take out one Canadian who wanted to end the genocidal madness inflicted on 25 million Americans, 5 million Canadians, and millions of Mexicans, Colombians, Central and South Americans. That's 6,000 pages representing hundreds and hundreds of officials, police, spies, informer, DEA, RCMP, elected officials, cabinet departments using millions and millions of taxpayer dollars to put me in their gulag, to discredit my work and paint me as the Ho Chi Minh in America's drug war Vietnam. Now, what did I really do in those 15 years from 1990 to 2005? Well, for 10 years from 1995 to 2005, I sold cannabis seeds to consenting adults. With the money people sent me, I paid my suppliers, my advertising, and my employees, and I paid taxes on those sales, and gave away $4 million over 10 years to over 350 organizations, activists, political parties, marches, rallies, drug addiction clinics, court challenges, ballot initiatives, class action lawsuits, and so much more. You know what, I was thinking about it, so I wrote down a fraction of that huge list of things I put $4 million to. So here's a few of them. I gave $85,000 to the Canadian Supreme Court challenge from 1995 to 2003. That's what it took, 8 years, culminating in our 6-3 loss at the Supreme Court in December 2003. I gave $35,000 each year to finance the global marijuana marches from 1999 to 2005. That's $245,000 over 7 years. I gave $28,000 to a class action suit against the U.S. federal government in 1999 out of Philadelphia. We were trying to reinstate the compassionate use cannabis program. We brought in 80 medical users from across America to Philadelphia to testify and put them up in hotels. We paid for the transportation and the hotel costs and legal fees in that class action suit. We gave $205,000 to finance the Iboga Therapy House in British Columbia. We treated 65 hardcore drug addicts from 2002 to 2004 at an average cost per patient of $4,000 each. We didn't ever charge them a dime, using ibogaine hydrochloride. Now, I was the head facilitator there, and ibogaine hydrochloride was just shown last night on an episode of Law and Order, SVU, in a completely factual light that shows them that ibogaine cures drug addiction and stops drug craving and drug withdrawal. I was one of the earliest pioneers of its use in North America, and now, 7 years later, it's finally penetrating the mainstream media in positive ways. I gave $15,000 to defend the Vancouver Island Compassion Club when it was raided by Victoria Police in 2003. I paid $5,000 to get petitioning done for the successful 1998 Washington, D.C. medical marijuana ballot initiative that finally became law only last year. I gave $10,000 to the 2000 Arizona medical marijuana ballot initiative. I gave $14,000 to the 2000, 2002, and 2004 Alaska marijuana legalization initiatives. And I gave $5,000 to the Colorado medical marijuana initiative in 2002. I gave $6,000 to the New Zealand legalized cannabis party newspaper advertising in their 1999 election. and I gave $3,000 to the Israeli marijuana party called the Green Leaf Party for their 2003 election campaign. I gave $152,000 to the BC Marijuana Party in 2001 to finance their massive 79-candidate full-slate provincial election campaign. To this day, I remain the largest donor to a political party cause in the history of British Columbia. I gave $35,000 to the year 2000 Canadian Medical Marijuana Party campaign across Canada. I gave $8,000 to promote the NDP campaign in 2004, as Jack Layton had promised to promote an end to marijuana prohibition, and we were fully behind him. We gave $10,000 to finance an anti-prohibition march in London, England in 2002. We gave $2,000 to a South African campaign for hemp houses for the homeless in 2002. We gave $30,000 to launch the U.S. Marijuana Party from 2003 to 2004. We paid $3,500 to send observers to Colombia to interview farmers victimized by the aerial spraying under the U.S.-sponsored Plan Colombia. We gave $5,000 to the Nimbin Mardi Gras in Australia in 2002. We gave $5,000 to sponsor an Arab-Israeli peace conference in Jerusalem in 2006. And we gave $15,000 in 1998 to get the Marijuana Policy Project off the ground before they had their millionaire sponsors that they have now. There were over 350 separate projects like those that I contributed up to $4 million in total from 1994 to 2006. With all that money I kept, I put out 74 issues of over 15 years of the best truth-telling magazine about cannabis that ever was, Cannabis Culture Magazine. Among our journalism was an in-person interview with Evo Morales, now the president of Bolivia, when he was the head of the Coca Farmers Union in 2002. We interviewed witnesses to the destruction of the Putayama Basin in Colombia from Plan Colombia's U.S. pesticidal spraying. I used our earnings to put out 3,000 videos on the first cannabis video streaming website in the world, Pot TV, 6 years before YouTube, at a cost of $1 million from the year 2000 to 2006. Video streaming in those days got up to $12,000, $15,000 a month for such pioneering technology. I used our earnings to fund and finance the BC Marijuana Party, fielding a full slate of 79 candidates in the 2001 BC election campaign. I paid for the 2000 Canadian Marijuana Party election campaign. I paid for lawyers all over North America to defend medical marijuana dispensaries in Victoria, BC, London, Ontario, Toronto, Ontario, St. John, New Brunswick, California, Washington State, and Oregon. I pioneered the most widespread research into cannabis genetics that had ever been attempted in modern times, creating a pool of cannabis genetics that has to this day been a great legacy to our cannabis culture all over the world. Our website, cannabisculture.com, has always been one of the movement's chief sources of inspiration and activism. I have mentored and inspired many of the world's most successful cannabis activists, Dana Larson, David Malmo-Levine, Mason Tvert, Loretta Knoll, Barry Cooper, and so many others. I pioneered the Cannabis Cafe in 1997, an all-hemp food cafe with vaporizers at every table to vaporize cannabis, the first of their kind. What I did was tell the truth loudly and urge thousands of people to think for themselves, get out to vote, be nonviolent and committed to the defense of liberty, march for our cause, pass ballot initiatives, provide a political voice for our movement, a media voice, and leave a genetic legacy that to this day is why California has such a staggering array of cannabis strains, a 20-year resume of activism and achievement that is simply unequaled by any other single individual in the history of our movement. In my first podcast from jail, I reviewed a new and important book by Jeremy Kuzmarov called The Myth of the Addicted Army, which looked at the failure of the U.S. government to successfully impose its apocalyptic end-of-days vision on the Asian country of Vietnam. The Holocaust that is America's historic legacy, the extermination of 2 million Vietnamese and the death of 58,000 U.S. soldiers in a cynical and obscene war. The Vietnam War has not had an ounce of nobility or legitimacy to it even then or historically in retrospect. The president and the generals lied to the soldiers and the people. Its soldiers raped, tortured, and killed children, women, and men with a depraved lust. Indeed, the execution of the war against these Asian peasants was so immoral that 102,000 U.S. servicemen have committed suicides in the 35 years following the U.S. exit from that genocidal war. That's 3,000 servicemen who've killed themselves every year, 10 every single day on average. The rapes, the needless slaughter, the torture, the napalm, the futility was all too much for once decent Americans to bear any longer. Thousands of other Vietnam veterans over the last 35 years have went on violent rampages of death, killing family members, co-workers, and strangers. These were shattered young men destroyed by a war of empire, a war on gooks, as the Vietnamese were called, to make them appear subhuman to the largely poor and black soldiers of the U.S. invaders. General Barry McCafferty, a drug czar under Bill Clinton and a commanding officer in Vietnam, blamed drug use by soldiers in Vietnam for the failure of the war in Southeast Asia. McCafferty's view was that the rapes and the fragging of officers by enlisting men, the slaughter of the peasants like at My Lai, were the result of use of heroin and marijuana. McCafferty never accepted that the mission itself, invading and occupying and destroying an Asian culture thousands of years old, was immoral and therefore unwinnable as a war. When I was arrested for seed distribution, U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez had put me on the list of the 50 most wanted drug kingpins in the world, and the most dangerous target of the U.S. Justice Department in all of Canada, and the only Canadian in his top 50 most wanted list. You know, in 2007, when Prime Minister Stephen Harper met with U.S. President George Bush and Mexican President Vicente Fox to discuss trilateral concerns in Mexico, CNN's Lou Dobbs interviewed the DEA on that very same episode, that very same news item, on the drug flow between the three countries. And incredibly, the only item of note in that entire report on drugs was the DEA, and they chose to talk exclusively about me, saying I was responsible, get this, for 100,000 pounds of dry marijuana for every year I was in the seed business, which was 11 years from 1995 to 2005. So that means the DEA claimed I was responsible for 1,100,000 pounds of marijuana. Was I on the list of topics that Stephen Harper and George Bush were discussing at that very conference? CNN and the DEA certainly made it seem so at this summit. When District Attorney Jeff Sullivan spoke to television news media on the day of my arrest on Friday, July 29, 2005, behind him was a wall map of the United States with arrows coming from Vancouver, Canada, into the United States below, all 50 of them, as though this was a movement of soldiers on a military map. Sullivan intoned, Emery's tentacles reached into all 50 states. And indeed, on the giant map in each state, there was a bright green cannabis leaf, prominently in all 48 continental states, like Viet Cong flags on each province of Vietnam. And those curved arrows leading from my Vancouver redoubt in the Great White North into Idaho, Washington, California, were like the marijuana equivalent of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Cannabis awareness and seeds coming in such quantity as to appear to overwhelm the U.S. government's border defenses. As I watched that television report, it's featured in the movie Prince of Pot, U.S. versus Mark Emery on DVD, and you should take a look at that, I realized then that it was being presented like a Canadian-made Tet Offensive. It was 1968 all over again, blaming the gooks for America's colossal moral failure. One man, in many ways, did in fact stop the Vietnam War. With 7,000 pages of secret Pentagon documents, a Rand Corporation employee, a Dr. Daniel Ellsberg, released what came to be known as the Pentagon Papers. And it was 7,000 pages of the U.S. government's own research and correspondence and memos from all the decision makers in the Pentagon and Department of Defense about the conduct of the Vietnam War. It showed in revelatory detail the U.S. government was consistently lying to the U.S. people about the war in Vietnam. The U.S. government had installed brutal dictators in Cambodia and Vietnam, invented and faked pretexts for invading Vietnam, ignored the obvious history of Vietnam itself, supported the previous French colonial oppressors, lied to its troop about the possibility of winning, concealed U.S.-led massacres like My Lai, distributed amphetamines and dangerous drugs to its own troops, organized and ran brothels, enslaving thousands of Vietnamese girls and women. Its CIA was distributing heroin to U.S. soldiers to finance assassination, often of Vietnamese people who opposed the war, and tortured them too. And smuggling heroin to the United States in the coffins of U.S. dead soldiers was the CIA, sometimes sewn right into the corpse of a U.S. soldier. The use of chemical defoliants produced by Dow Chemical stripped rainforests of vegetation and killed tens of thousands of Vietnamese by poisoning and hundreds of U.S. soldiers. And napalm hideously disfigured hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese peasants for no strategic purpose whatsoever. It was, in fact, all in the Pentagon Papers. And it was a big obscene lie after obscene lie, a gigantic U.S. crime against humanity laid bare by the government of the United States' own records, in much the same way Nazi Germany kept meticulous records of its mass murder in the Holocaust. The Pentagon Papers were never meant to be seen by U.S. citizens or civilians or journalists or anyone. It was a top secret classified for national security eyes only, meant only to be seen by the top generals and the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense. It was at the RAND Corporation because that was the chief research contractor employed by the Pentagon for decades since World War II and was considered to have top security clearance only. Henry Kissinger, President Nixon's Secretary of State, called Daniel Ellsberg the most dangerous man in America for releasing the Pentagon Papers, and he was Kissinger's most wanted. Henry Kissinger was Nixon's most evil henchman, responsible for advising Nixon to bomb civilian targets in Vietnam from 1969 to 1972, a massive incendiary bombing that killed 500,000 Vietnamese. Kissinger was responsible for the invasion of Cambodia that led to the destabilization that made Pol Pot's rise inevitable. Kissinger, incredibly, was awarded the 1973 Nobel Prize for ending the Vietnam War, permanently discrediting the Peace Prize. While Kissinger was receiving his Peace Prize in October 1973, he was directing the CIA-led overthrow of the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende in Chile and installing the dictatorship of General Augusto Pinochet, with several hundred killed in this U.S.-led coup. Talk about ironies. Well, Daniel Ellsberg was a psychiatrist employed at RAND Corporation and a researcher, and traumatized by what was contained in the Pentagon Papers, a worker there confided to Ellsberg the horrifying contents. Ellsberg retrieved the 7,000 pages out of a high-security safe, photocopied all 7,000 pages, and gave them to the New York Times and the Washington Post, who published them. Over 1 million copies of the Pentagon Papers were sold in 1 month in 1972 alone. Said Ellsberg, quote, "I was willing to do anything nonviolent and truthful. I realized that the one thing I could do was copy the study I had on the origins of the war. I had 7,000 pages of top-secret documents in my safe at the RAND Corporation, evidence of a century of aggression, broken treaties, deception, stolen elections, and murders. I had proof of it all," end quote. By the way, that's a quote from the book Patriots, The Vietnam War Remembered from All Sides by Christian G. Appy. Sure makes me wonder what's in those 6,000 pages of the Canadian government's Emory papers. I'm sure both the U.S. government as well as the Canadian government has their file of 6,000 pages. A U.S. journalist ought to put in a Freedom of Information request to the U.S. government for all its documents on the case against Mark Emory. It's certain to reveal over a decade of prohibitionist hallucinations, deceptions, lies, and illegalities laid out in clear detail. You know, Canadian Member of Parliament Libby Davies has an order paper request for those 6,000 pages of the Emory papers on the floor of the House of Commons from September 27th. Legally, it must be produced within 45 days, and that was due November 12th, sometime last week. Davies wants to see those 6,000 pages uncensored, to see what collusion the Canadian government and its agencies and police have engaged in with what is likely to be the worst, most evil forces within the U.S. government. Ostensibly, over one man, me, who published magazines, videos, told the truth, empowered a generation of activists to pursue the truth, distributed seeds in perhaps the most remarkable peaceful revolution of our modern times. I'm sure these 6,000 Emory paper pages, if we can ever see them uncensored, will be as intellectually nauseating and morally exhausting as it was reading Nixon's own recorded conversations. For both the Vietnam War and the drug war today come from the same delusional, unhinged, anti-life, end-of-days mentality of Richard Nixon. Nixon decided to wage war on the young people who led the opposition to his genocidal war in Vietnam. It was the marijuana culture and their pacifism at home in the USA and among the soldiers in Vietnam that Nixon and McCaffrey blamed for the failure in Vietnam. Nixon's enduring legacy is the drug war, the pot smokers as the Viet Cong, a view continued by Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, George W., and now Obama, to its natural conclusion that Mark Emory is the Ho Chi Minh bringing the seeds of freedom to overgrow the imperial U.S. prison military death machine. Except for the problem for the U.S. federal government is that I, first and foremost, am an acolyte of Ayn Rand and Ron Paul, and the principles those two articulate in their great works. I am anything but Che Guevara or Uncle Ho. My heroes for my entire life are all Americans. Ayn Rand, Ron Paul, Thomas Jefferson, Lysander Spooner, Martin Luther King Jr., Clarence Darrow, Thomas Edison. Not any communist or anti-American rebel. No smear is ever going to taint my life's work dedicated to individual liberty and the rights of man. My 30 years of transparent, principled advocacy of liberty is clear and well documented. Watch my hundreds of YouTube Pot TV videos. Read those 74 issues of Cannabis Culture magazine. Consider where that $4 million I gave away went to. All peaceful democratic institutions, political parties, politicians, activists, lobbyists, rallies, marches, court actions. Not a gun, bullet, explosive was ever paid for with my money. Just pens, printing presses. addresses, gardening advice, peaceful demonstrations. The stuff America was made of at its most ideal, in its origins. Even George Washington, the first president of the Republic, was a prodigious cannabis farmer and seed distributor who indeed overgrew the British Empire himself. When the 6,000 pages of the Emory Papers are one day revealed uncensored, we will see that the inner workings of the police state, that security that secretly watches us all and controls our lives. Who knows what names of high-ranking officials, spies, informers, as well as those spied upon, will be revealed in those top-secret pages. I talked to many, many people in those 10 years who knows what was being spied upon and who was being spied upon. Revealing what is in the Emory Papers will expose the existence of the secret North American National Security Marijuana Police that fights a culture war on behalf of our two quickly integrating governments of Canada and the USA. 6,000 pages is bigger than the U.S. government's file on John Lennon, even bigger than the file the FBI kept on Martin Luther King Jr. The scope of the Emory Papers, all 6,000 pages classified, marked national security, with every one of its approximately 3 million words blacked out, is breathtaking, possibly the biggest spy job these two governments have ever pulled off. Millions of dollars, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars, has been spent on one man whose pitch is essentially, think for yourself. If anyone in the cosmos still needs proof that the authority fear marijuana more than anything else, that person would only need to look at the mere existence of the Emory Papers. The lies and corruption in those 6,000 pages have cost countless lives and incalculable suffering. These lies are so obvious and damning that the government knows it has to black out every word. Any action will be taken to stop the freedom of thought that marijuana represents, according to our two governments. The actual uncensored pages, read in their whacked-out entirety, will reveal the diseased and warped thinking of those who pursue prohibition, that's for sure. Reading the 6,000 pages of the government's top-secret Emory files will be like reading something out of the Salem witch trials. The Emory Papers will have the logic and mood of a Jim Jones sermon at the People's Temple. Imagine how many other pages and memos and investigations into the Canadian cannabis culture are out there that no one knows about. The drug war drives the U.S. imperial empire and its manifest destiny. That is why drugs are insinuated in all U.S. occupations, invasions, and subversions, from Vietnam to Afghanistan to Colombia to Bolivia to Mexico. It drives Stephen Harper's re-election strategy to establish an unprecedented prison state in Canada. Both the Bush administration and the Harperites have these end-of-times nuts driving the drug war, as did Reagan, Bush Sr., and Nixon. Now the Harperites have written it all down in overblown national security only prose, only a book of revelations inspired fanatic can deliver. Daniel Ellsberg said what made the Pentagon Papers a big deal was Nixon's opposition to its release, just as the Harper government has opposed releasing a single word of the 6,000 pages of the Emory Papers. Those who are listening to me now must insist that all 6,000 of those pages be released, uncensored and complete. Demand that your member of parliament tell the government of Stephen Harper and the fundamentalist ministers he has in his cabinet, Stockwell Day, the Minister of Public Safety, Peter Van Loan, and Attorney General Rob Nicholson, to release the Emory Papers uncensored. To what degree is the secret U.S.-Canada National Security Marijuana Police Network spying on Canadian citizens? You'll need to see the Emory Papers to find out. How many laws have been broken by governments and police during this decade-long production of Orwell's 1984? And let us not forget that Canada has passed laws that allow the police, the RCMP particularly, to commit crimes if they are pursuing the drug war. To know the truth, you will need to see the Emory Papers to find out. Do you live in a documented police state? You must read the Emory Papers to find out. The Emory Papers will prove what we already know. The only hope is to vote and get all the others you know to vote too. People can vote without any risk. Nobody knows how you vote. If you don't vote in this election coming up, then you will be hunted down forever. The existence of 6,000 pages of the Emory Papers proves that. I urge all of you to listen to my podcast, Stephen Harper and the End of Days of Canada as We Know It, Revelations into the Conservative Party's Plan for Canada. Yes, it's a long and detailed podcast. It takes over an hour, I'm afraid. But it's a complete understanding of the end of times nut bars who control the government of Canada and who have controlled much of the government of the United States, particularly during the Bush administration. Listen to it carefully and tell others to listen to it. It's being typed up right now and will be posted online so you can read it and distribute it to as many Canadians as possible. Use that text and take it to candidates' meetings. Conservative candidates, including all the fundamentalist Christian ones, and there are many, hide from journalists. They hide from interviewers and they avoid all the candidates' debates. We are dealing with religious zealots who revel in the return of the Inquisition and its dungeons. They will torch the world burning plants as they did witches and put the cannabis believers in increasingly bleak prisons. They proudly admit it themselves on their website, like Chris Somerville's websites, the Harper's new chief of Canada's Mental Health Commission, and they detail their apocalyptic beliefs clearly. In terms of mainstream politics, the scam originated with Reform Party founder Preston Manning. He's the inspiration for the neocon nightmare that has infected the politics of both our two countries, the United States and Canada. Prominent U.S. fundamentalist neocon politician Newt Gingrich credits Preston Manning with his biblically inspired hallucinations with being a driving force to the U.S. Republican Party's resurgence after Nixon sullied the brand with his overt gutter snipe evil. The Harperites and Bush religious right Republicans operate as one transnational Christian conservative movement, sharing advisors and strategy interchangeably. The politics that inspire Harper and his Christian yes-men and Republican religious neocons in the United States go back to Preston Manning's Back to the Bible Hour radio broadcast he made weekly from the mid-1960s to the 1980s. Preston Manning's Christian certainties were brought to life, given form as the conservative ethos for ruling the North American continent. Declared Preston Manning at the 1996 Reform Assembly. Our political work, therefore, involves seeking out that worried Canadian at home, on the street, or in the workplace. We offer that worried Canadian greater economic opportunity, personal security, and freedom from fear. That premise by Manning is important when you see how in the years since his acolyte and born-again convert Stephen Harper's more recent speeches and comments about fighting the permissiveness of the 1960s, fighting the culture of the 1960s, and fighting the individual libertarian principles of that wonderful era of change. Particularly when Harper launched Canada's new national drug strategy in November 2007. It's more prisons, dungeons, and inquisitions, and the lake of fire that equals personal security and freedom from fear, to quote again Preston Manning. Harper and Manning's fear of mainstream Canadian culture, the 1960s culture, the cannabis culture, is the guiding light for this government, and it will be clear what they have in store for all of us, those who believe in the 60s culture, of inquiry, truth, dissent, rock and roll, marijuana, peace and unity of all peoples, when you see those 6,000 pages of the Emory Pages uncensored. Says Gordon Laird in his remarkable book, Slumming It at the Rodeo, The Cultural Roots of Canada's Right-Wing Revolution. In evangelical terms, culture is any human activity framed through the dualities of sin and virtue, damnation and redemption. Most of all, Preston Manning argues populist politics is the cultural struggle of a minority to pursue the Babylon majority, to persuade the Babylon majority of their wrongful ways. Manning preached about the spiritual bankruptcy of modern society on his father's Back to the Bible radio broadcast as far back as 1967, citing epidemic juvenile delinquency, adult crime, drug addiction, drunkenness, adultery, divorce, prostitution, homosexuality, and general moral laxity. Manning railed on about how we needed a new rise in the political right to deal with those issues. Everything is at stake in the next upcoming election. After the election, if the worst happens, and that's a Harper majority government, you will wonder, hey, why didn't I listen to Mark Emery as Canada rapidly, and believe me, it will be rapid, turns into the dark ages. You'll realize it was all predicted ahead of time by a guy out of an 8.5 by 10 foot concrete jail cell. The problem will be you will be in jail with me, and there will be many more jails and dungeons, and Canadians will be living the lives of robots, frightened of the new jails that are being built all around them, or they will be working 8 days a week to pay for Canada's new jails, tens of thousands of new prisoners, and the nation's catastrophic debt and its homogenous anti-life culture will be all around us. The marijuana culture is truly the enemy in Harper's culture war. I am the leader of the cannabis culture, so by deduction, Harper has his greatest philosophical enemy in jail and ready to send to the U.S. gulag, where prisoner rape, violence, degradation, and murder are common. Marijuana people, by pursuing the truth, are the same as Daniel Ellsberg, who pursued the truth. Ellsberg was called a traitor by the Nixon government. Harper is serious about his culture war and the drug war as Nixon was. Make no mistake about it. When they say culture war, they mean it. And war means you can do anything to destroy the enemy. Look how the U.S. killed Vietnamese, Iraqis, and Afghanis in those wars. Look how the DEA, SWAT teams, the RCMP, local police all wage a brutal drug war with intense violence. In Vietnam, the phrase was, in order to save Vietnam, we had to destroy it. Look at what the Americans have done to destroy Iraq and Afghanistan, and look how they destroyed Vietnam. Look at the shattered lives of millions of in the U.S. of Canada have sent to their drug gulag since Nixon declared drugs public enemy number one. When they say the sinners will burn in a lake of fire, they mean it. This is the mentality that is making our laws today. Even Obama is listening to these people now, taking instruction from Christian neocons. And once I am gone to the U.S. gulag, the Harperites and Bushites that still dominate the DEA, the Justice Department, the RCMP, and the Canadian government will rejoice. That is why the persecution against me knows no limit, morally or financially. That is why I'm at great risk in a U.S. jail, which I'm sure is only weeks away. That is why I'm doing this podcast now, as I believe my delivery into the belly of the beast is imminent. My writing is done by my right hand in an 8-foot by 10-foot cell. Break my fingers or my thumb, I can't write the truth anymore. Injure me, put me in pain, I won't be able to think straight. Break my spirit, make me mad in isolation, or put me with thugs, or put me on bus therapy, stop my voice. Any of those things are possible in the U.S. gulag. So I'm telling you this now on the eve of my delivery to the great Satan. Consider how much the Canadian U.S. government has invested in to get me put away. How long do you think it will be before they try to destroy me? The 6,000-page top-secret national security-only Emory papers held by the Canadian and American governments would no doubt tell us why.